Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jessica Levinson, the Vice President of the Los Angeles Ethics Commission and a professor at Loyola Law School, where she focuses on election law and governance issues, including campaign finance, ethics, and state budgets. She wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court in McCormish versus Bennett, the case in which John Roberts and four other justices ruled to limit public funding in elections. She is the editor of the blog polawtix.blogspot.com and has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Supreme Court ruling as if we don't have enough money in politics already. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jessica Levinson.
Thank you so much for having me.
And yesterday, Jessica, I spoke with Robert Weisman, the head of Public Citizen, who's they're organizing a national protest against the McCutcheon decision. And I got some mail from listeners complaining that Weisman's claim that donors now could write a single check for $5.9 million to candidates, parties, or political committees is inaccurate. What's your understanding of that figure?
Well, my understanding is that actually the Supreme Court wasn't entirely clear on this themselves during the oral arguments in McCutcheon versus FEC. You saw them kind of banter about different numbers. The numbers that I've heard are about 3.5, 3.6 million, which essentially means that you max out on the base contributions to all candidates and all political committees that give to candidates. You know, the truth is we're talking about $2 million here or there, which I think proves the point that for the vast majority of people, and I mean 99.5% of Americans, we're not worried about whether we can give more than $120,000 to candidates total. And that's what this decision really talks about. This decision is focused on those particularly wealthy donors and what they can do with respect to total giving to candidates and committees.
So what is the limit then on the single candidate that you can donate to both in the primary and the general?
So it's $2,600 indexed for inflation. It was reset under McCain-Feingold, and that's each election, meaning primary and general elections being separate elections. People can give about $5,000 to political action committees. So there are a lot of ways to get substantial amounts of sums directly to candidates, and now you don't have to limit the number of candidates that you can give to.
But, of course, you have this vast loophole that you could, you know, drive a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier through, and that is these super PACs, these 501c4s, which don't require any attribution to who's giving the money. You can give unlimited amounts of money, and as your article in the LA Times points out, these various front groups like Restore Our Future, American Crossroads, Priorities USA, et cetera, spent $830 million in the 2012 elections without having to disclose their donors. So that is hardly an example of constraints on the abilities of the, 0.1% to finance elections.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, frankly, that's why a lot of people like me who believe in campaign finance restrictions or at least think that they embrace good public policy really were saying to ourselves, you know, in some ways this decision is based on which mechanism do you want people to give money to? Is it the independent groups, which, as you said, you can give unlimited sums to these groups, the groups can spend unlimited sums, or is it directly to candidates and political parties, or is it both? And I think that what this decision really embraces is it's just another example of the whittling away of any semblance of a comprehensive campaign finance scheme, which, frankly, we've never seen come to fruition in our country. But I do think, to your point, you know, a lot of people were saying, well, if I can give unlimited sums to independent expenditure groups and I don't have to necessarily disclose who I am, then what's the problem with just giving the base contributions to a lot of different candidates? How can that raise the specter of corruption or the appearance of corruption? My response to that is it absolutely can, but I think the Supreme Court has created an environment where money flows so freely throughout our political system that now anytime we have one restriction, people are saying, well, what does that one restriction do? Well, unfortunately, given the climate that the Supreme Court created, sometimes not everything. So we're in a very difficult position because of the court's decisions.
And just back to that earlier point about the Supreme Court not being exactly clear about what the limits are, could it still be that that you could write a check for $5.9 million? Or do you think that Weissman was off on that number?
So I would really want to check where Weissman got that number before I say he was certainly off, because I have a lot of respect for the work that he does.
Mm-hmm.
I know in the oral arguments, the discussion was $3.5, $3.6 million, and that's the figure that I've seen more frequently.
Well, of course, in those oral discussions that you just mentioned, Jessica Levinson, Justice Antonin Scalia said in the October hearing, quoting, "I don't think $3.5 million is a heck of a lot of money."
Right.
You know, you have to ask yourself, what planet are these guys on?
So I think that a lot of the Supreme Court's rulings do not embrace what I see is a practical, common sense, real world view of campaigns. I think there are legitimate rights and expectations on both sides of the balance when it comes to giving and spending money in politics. But in my mind, the Supreme Court just really miscalculates the pernicious influence of money and, frankly, how much money most people can spend. You know, the vast majority of people give no money. And, you know, then there are some people who give small sums to candidates that they really support. And then there are fewer people who are maxing out. And then there are even fewer people who are giving the large sums that we typically talk about in the media. And those are the people who are discussed most frequently in the Supreme Court's opinion. What we don't see in the majority opinion is a discussion of what does this mean for the speech rights of all of the other participants in our democracy, all of the other voters, all of the people who want to listen and want to speak. You know, what does giving a few people a much louder microphone mean for them?
Again, I'm speaking with Jessica Levinson, the Vice President of the Los Angeles Ethics Commission and a professor at Loyola Law School, where she focuses on election law and governance issues, including campaign finance, ethics, and state budgets. She wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court in McCormish versus Bennett, the case in which John Roberts and four other justices ruled to limit public spending in elections. And she's the editor of the blog polawticks.blogspot.com. And has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Supreme Court ruling as if we don't have enough money in politics already. But I find this ruling to be intensely partisan, and I do wonder, and I broached that with Robert Weissman yesterday, whether or not we are being too generous in talking about these jurists as stewards of our laws and wrapping all of these decisions in legalese, when it appears that they're basically political operatives for the Republican Party. Now, you may not agree with that, but you can't deny the fact that this case was brought to the Supreme Court by the Republican National Committee.
I think that's right, but truthfully, I think that the lifting of the aggregate contribution limits could actually help both political parties, because party leaders will be able to say, you know, you used to give to those independent groups, but now you should just give to us because we are best organized and best situated and can best get money to the candidates who need the money and can help do what you want to do, which is to get certain candidates elected. And so the truth is, I think that the Democratic Party could benefit from this decision. Of course, we don't know until we see how behavior changes. I mean, certainly the division on the court was between those justices that were appointed by Republicans and those justices that were appointed by Democratic presidents. But I think this comes down to, in a lot of ways, an ideological divide between whether you think money is speech and how corrupting you think money is in the political process. And frankly, I think it's personally very sad that it's become a partisan issue when really I think it should just be an issue of those two questions. If you think that money is speech, then it's difficult to explain why we should limit it. I don't think money is speech. I think money is money and it enables speech. And if you think that money does not have significant corrupting potential, I think that you're not necessarily plugged into the real world, but then there's not good reasons to limit that flow of money. So I think what we have is an ideological divide that is coming down on partisan lines.
Well, but the fact of the matter is that the case was brought by the Republican National Committee, and Reince Priebus, the head of the RNC, celebrated its the ruling yesterday. So the Republicans clearly think this gives them an advantage. That would be the only conclusion one could come to.
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, you know, Citizens United also was celebrated by a lot of Republicans and initially bemoaned by Democrats. But the truth is, I think Republicans are just better at raising and spending corporate money, and therefore one can argue that the decision is a lot more beneficial for them. But when it comes to McCutcheon, you know, I actually don't know how we're going to see this play out a few election cycles from now. You know, listeners can think that I'm very naive, and you may think so as well, but I think only time will tell which political party, or whether it's both political parties, will really benefit from this decision.
Well, so far, in comparison to Reince Priebus's celebration of this ruling, Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader in the House, described the decision as really sad and a significant blow to the democratic process. Quoting, "Is this supposed to be a money war? Is this what this is? Our founders sacrificed everything, their lives, their liberty, their sacred honor for a democracy, a government of the many, not a government of the money." So she's obviously not thinking that this is going to work out well for the Democrats.
Well, I think that she's also making a statement that's consistent with her previous positions, and there's nothing wrong with that, which is that Democrats have typically been in favor of more restrictions. I think in larger numbers holding the belief that money can be a corrupting influence. But, you know, the truth is our Democratic president certainly raised huge sums of money, has not done an enormous amount to reform the electoral processes, and was, you know, the one of the first people in recent history to say, "I'm not going to take public financing." So I think that we can look at people on both sides of the aisle. Absolutely, the reaction has been from the Republican Party leadership that this is a good decision, from the Democratic Party leadership to bemoan the decision. But I think, like Citizens United, which was the first, my first appearance, I think, on Background Briefing, we're going to have to give it a few election cycles to see how it plays out and who it most benefits.
But surely, Jessica Levinson, you can make the comparison that what this ruling does, and you mentioned how much Obama had to raise, and there's no question that raising all that money takes a lot of time. And the Senate used to work 5 days a week, and now they work barely 2 days a week because they're off in the district or at fundraisers. And fundraisers go on around the clock on Capitol Hill. So what happens is that basically our politicians spend more time raising money than they do doing the people's business. Now, if you have a fundamental ideological difference between the two parties, which you clearly have, the Democrats, even though they have a they have their Wall Street branch of the Democratic Party, and then they have the Democratic branch of the Democratic Party, but at least in the Democratic branch of the Democratic Party, they believe in government. They would rather be doing the people's business than raising funds. I'm not sure on the other side, the Republicans, most of whom don't believe in government, are particularly unhappy that they don't do any work for the government. They basically spend all their time raising money.
Well, so I'm not sure. I mean, I will say that I'm not sure that on either side of the aisle, people who want to go to their city halls or to their county seats or to their state capitals or to D.C. really cherish the amount of time that they spend fundraising. I mean, you could say that Republicans really want to spend time trying to repeal Obamacare as opposed to spending time with donors, and that Democrats really want to spend time talking about a minimum wage than they do fundraising. So I'm not at all convinced that there are vast majorities on either side that cherish the current situation that you talk about, which is clearly one of getting on a fundraising treadmill that just never stops and does nothing essentially but speed up. And I think that it is such a pernicious system, and it really turns the voters off in such a deep way, and it makes the voters feel like politics is really just a game for people who have money. And unfortunately, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because fewer people go to the polls. And then what we have is elections where we're seeing turnouts in the teens and the low 20s. And that is so detrimental, I think, to a representative system of government.
Well, Jessica Leveson, just in closing, though, even with the limits now of 2,600 for one candidate for the primary and 2,600 for the same candidate for the general, $5,200. Who has $5,200 to give to a politician? I'd say 99% of Americans don't, or maybe 98%. I mean, you know, I once organized a fundraiser, $1,000 a head. It was absolute agony trying to corral a bunch of people. And, you know, in this town, you do have a lot of rich people, in particularly in show business. But it was the most soul-destroying experience I've ever had, and it was a difficult experience. Even amongst rich people, prying $1,000 loose was not easy. So I just think this whole situation clearly limits the game. If you're talking about a casino in Vegas, the only people who can buy in to this casino are the super rich.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you give us some great perspective here, which is we're not talking about, oh, is the upper middle class going to be able to max out on their campaign contributions? What we're talking about is really the upper echelon of the upper echelon that can spend more than $120,000 a year just giving directly to candidates. And if that's the amount that you can spend, or in a two-year election cycle, if that's the amount that you can spend, you're making an enormous sum every year, which is fine, but most people are not making that level of money. And so for a lot of people, this problem is just not one that they can even fathom. Unfortunately, I think the Supreme Court has created a problem that we're all beginning to fathom and will continue to do so throughout subsequent elections.
Well, Jessica Leveson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jessica Leveson, who's the Vice President of the Los Angeles Ethics Commission and a professor at Loyola Law School, where she focuses on election law and governance issues, including campaign finance, ethics, and state budgets. She wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court in McCormish versus Bennett, the case in which John Roberts and four other justices ruled to limit public funding in elections. She's the editor of the blog polawtix.blogspot.com, and has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Supreme Court ruling as if we don't have enough money in politics already. We're going to take a brief station break, and with the possible freeing of the American spy for Israel, Jonathan Pollard, we'll be speaking with the person who did the assessment of the damage that Pollard did to American intelligence.